From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Singer-songwriter Randy Newman has long been considered one of the sharpest wits in rock. His songs are seldom autobiographical, but on today's Fresh Air, Randy Newman talks with us about his life. Also today, we meet a lyricist who isn't nearly as well known to jazz fans as her most popular song is. Fran Landesman wrote the lyric to "Spring Can Really Hang You Up the Most." Rock historian Ed Ward looks back at the formation of the Five Royales, and book critic John Leonard reviews The Shah's Last Ride, William Shawcross's account of the final days of the Shah of Iran. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Randy Newman is one of the rock world's wittiest, most cynical, and most literate songwriters. Rock critic Robert Christgau once called him a master craftsman. Newman has always avoided confessional lyrics, preferring to speak ironically through the often unsavory characters he creates for his songs. His song Sail Away is a sales pitch to Africans to come to America to be slaves. Political science suggests that no one likes us anyhow, so let's drop the big one now. Later songs were written from the perspective of bigots, homophobes, murderers, and grotesques. His best-known songs are Short People and I Love L.A. Randy Newman's song, singing, and piano playing evoke a wide array of influences, including blues, Tin Pan Alley, vaudeville, cabaret, and movie music. Newman has been recording since the late 1960s. He has his first new album in 5 years. It's called Land of Dreams, and it includes several autobiographical songs, including this one, which opens the album. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Pleasure being here.
Your new album has several autobiographical songs on it, and the record opens with the date and place of your birth. Hmm. And I wonder what made you interested in adding more autobiographical music to your repertoire.
Well, I thought about lying about making it. I was born right here November 53. You know? I actually did as sort of a joke, you know, as if an auspicious beginning. I don't know. I possibly because I hadn't done it before, and it, people had mentioned it, that I always was like either hiding behind characters, though I don't think that's quite true. But I wrote the first song. I wrote Dixie Flyer, and then I was... I felt interested sort of in going on a little bit.
Well, I guess the autobiography is distanced a little bit by the fact that it's from childhood. They're old memories about yourself.
They are, and they're full of lies. You know, New Orleans, I say that my father told New Orleans the war was over in 1948, and it's the type of town where they might not have known the war was over, but they knew before then. And we didn't live in the Garden District, really. It's a sort of a little New Orleans joke for the people down there. But it was a long time ago. And there's a few others that are faintly autobiographical also on the record, other than those opening three.
People always assume about novelists and songwriters that everything they have to say is autobiography. And I think that assumption has gotten you into a lot of trouble in the past with songs like Short People and songs about racism, mm-hmm. and homophobia. Some people have assumed that it's you really expressing those emotions. Are you always surprised by people who take your songs at face value?
No, at some of them. You know, there's a song of mine called Political Science where I talk about let's drop the big one because people don't like us. And a couple of people who assume that I would think that way in that particular song surprised me a bit. But they're not used to it. Really, novelists and short story writers have the latitude to where they you don't expect that it's John Updike. It's always me. It's always about John Updike, you know. And we should have that latitude, too. People don't avail themselves of it too much, but why can't we write in other characters if we want, you know, a song in the song form?
Well, I was wondering if one of the reasons why you did write in other characters was the influence of your uncles who were film composers, Alfred Newman and Lionel mm-hmm. Newman. I mean, your uncle Alfred wrote the scores for The Robe, The Hunchback of Notre Dame, Captain from Castile, mm-hmm. Prisoner of Zenda. And you were so exposed to music that had a programmatic context, that was, music that was about things other than the person who was writing it, music that described epic stories.
Yeah, it would have been hard to, I guess it would have been hard for me to, at 18, to find an epic story in my life. It may have had something to do, it certainly had something to do with going into music and with being interested in an orchestra, which is one of my first loves, is the sound of an orchestra. Writing in the third person the way I've done may have been reticence or some sort of shyness. I don't know, but it just always has interested me more and still does, despite this outbreak of autobiography here. I think it'll always be what I do because I'm interested in people who are a little off in some sort of way or in other characters, you know, other than myself.
Did your uncles, the film composers, teach you anything about music or ever take you with them to the soundstage?
Oh, yeah. I remember seeing my uncle doing, what's one of the first memories I have? I remember him doing All About Eve, which must have been 1950.
Mm.
Yeah, or maybe they were doing it in 49. I can't remember. I was like 5 years old, 6 years old. Yeah, I'd go to the soundstage. Things about conducting more often than actual music. I studied music independently of them, but I learned quite a bit.
I want to play one of the very personal songs, or at least I assume it is, from the new record. And this is Four Eyes. And I have to tell you that I listened to this song several times before I realized it's about a kid being taken to their first day of school.
Yeah.
Because I kept thinking, what is the father doing to this kid, abandoning him on the side of the road with a lunchbox, leaving him all alone before the sun's even come up in the morning? And I finally, on the fourth hearing or so, realized, oh, it's the first day of school.
Yeah, that's it. He wasn't being sent to a factory.
Well, how autobiographical is this song? Is this your horrible memories of the first day of school?
No, I don't remember it as that. I didn't wear glasses at that time. I had trouble with my eyes. I think my father told me that my eyes were like, there's muscle imbalance or was worse than, is operated on and stuff. And I was like cross-eyed, and I think I was afraid to look people in the eye because sometimes they'd look the other way because they think I wasn't looking at them. So he said I backed in to my first day of school when he dropped me off. But that's all I remember about it. Part of those three songs, the key to them is, in the second song it says, I don't remember much about my baby days, but I've been told. So much of our memories of those days are like, you know, they'll say, oh, you remember when you were 8 months old, you knew all the Beethoven symphonies. I'll say, oh, yeah, sure, I remember. But you don't remember that stuff. And it's not true. Your parents sort of mythologize your childhood.
And so you're re-mythologizing it now.
Yeah.
Okay, let's listen to the opening of Four Eyes from Randy Newman's new album, Land of Dreams.
One September morning, when I was five, my daddy said, son, rise from your bed. Must be dreaming. It's still dark outside. He said, son, if you fall behind, you'll never get ahead. Here's your little brown cowboy shirt. Put it on. Here's your little brown cowboy pants. Put them on. Here's your little brown shoe. Can you tie them yourself? Get into the car. We're gone.
I think your voice is very expressive on that.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I like that. I like that little 20th century music sneaks in there. That's right. Sort of scary music about tying your shoes, you know, sort of the anxiety music.
Do you feel ever a loss of control when there's a synthesizer more at the forefront than, say, your piano is?
No, not really. It just has to be. It took me like a little while, maybe, but not long. They can do so many things that they have to be used. That there's something about them that still bothers me occasionally, and that it always sounds to me as if it's coming out of a box. Mm-hmm. But I think it's just because I'm old. You know, I've discovered as I've gotten older that words of my father and that generation are like coming out of me. My kid will play me a record and he'll say, "What do you think of this?" And I'll say, "Well, you know, it's too loud." Now, what kind of intelligent assessment of anything is that? You know, it's too loud. But that's the type of things that old crocs say, and that's what I'm becoming, I think.
You know, in thinking about you performing, I was thinking that in a way it's lucky that you're a pianist, because my memories of you performing are always with your back slightly turned to the audience at mm-hmm. the piano, sitting down. And I have a hard time imagining you standing up, looking at an audience directly without the piano mm-hmm. between you and the audience.
Not as hard a time as I do. I'm supposed to do this week, or God knows when this is going to be on, but I'm supposed to do Saturday Night Live. And on It's Money That Matters, which I'll be doing, mm-hmm. I don't play anything. You know, it's like there's a little organ part, that's it. But it's guitar-oriented, so there's no piano. So this could unleash me, and I could stand up, and maybe I have it in me to be like a big star and just haven't known it, you know.
So is this going to be your first time standing up?
I don't think I'm going to do it. I'll just sit there and pretend to play something, you know, like one of the monkeys.
When you started writing songs, you started writing for other people. By the time you were 16, you were working for music companies.
Yeah.
Writing songs for people like Pat Boone and Jerry Butler, Dusty Springfield, the Fleetwoods.
Right.
Did you see yourself as becoming a pop songwriter instead of a performer, like a modern-day Tin Pan Alley man or a Lieber and Stoller type?
Oh, I'm such an admirer of theirs, so that would have been great. But
yeah.
That's what I saw. Because what I do now didn't really exist. You know, there wasn't Elton John and, mm-hmm. and songwriter performers. It just, it was the beginning stages of that. So that's what I thought I'd do. And I thought I'd do motion picture music. I was still studying for that.
Do you remember any of the songs that you did for other people when you were very young?
Sure.
Could you do one of the lyrics of a song that you thought was pretty good at the time?
Well, eventually, none of the lyrics impressed me much.
It was the music as well?
The first song, almost the first song I ever had published, I must have been 16, 17, was recorded by the Fleetwoods. It was called They Tell Me It's Summer, an attempt to get in on the summer fad. They tell me it's summer, but I know it's a lie, because summer's for laughing, all I do is cry. And anyway, it went on like that, you know, cry my girl world. But I was a kid, you know, I didn't know what a girl was.
Did the song sell?
It was on the back of a hit,
uh-huh.
A moderate hit, which is, I never had anything that was successful. We were a real unsuccessful sort of publishing company. We would try and be like Carole King and, you know, get the follow-ups to Carole King hits, but she would always get the follow-ups to Carole King hits.
Did the Beatles, when they started writing their own songs and all the other bands started writing their own songs, did that make the need for songwriters like you unnecessary? And did that lead you into performing yourself?
It changed things. No, I still was, you know, doing that. But people showed some interest in a couple of record companies in recording me. And I decided to do it. I've in every new stage, I've sort of been pulled, kicking and screaming. I've never had, like, the ambition that I've seen in some people who are in this business. I would have benefited tremendously if I'd had a little more, I don't know whether it's self-confidence or some sort of drive, you know, like I want to do this or I want to do that. I can't think of anything that I wanted to do. You know, it was just always people had to convince me to do stuff. It's like, I don't know what it was.
When you started writing songs for yourself, did you start writing songs that you thought fit your voice and your piano style? And if so, how did that change the songs you were writing?
It took me a while to do that. It's not easy. You have to sort of separate yourself as an artist from what you write. I still write as best I can with no consideration for anything. but I think instinctively I'm writing things that I know I can sing. I've done things that, when I've done old songs of mine in the initial first few albums that I weren't for me, you know, it's like I couldn't sing them very well, I don't think, but now I've got a better fix on that.
Well, how do you size up your voice when you're writing for yourself? What do you think of as your strengths and weaknesses?
You know, I wouldn't write people for me. I mean, I can't hold a note for very long, I don't think. I'm a good rock and roll singer, but it's a little limiting to me as a writer just to write that kind of stuff. It's what I sing best, probably. Blues, it's kind of a blues-oriented voice, I think. Mm-hmm. But I don't think of it consciously. I just do it. And sometimes there are songs that are more difficult for me than others.
Randy Newman is my guest. One of your best-known songs from the early 70s was Lonely at the Top. Now,
yeah.
You actually wrote that for Frank Sinatra. Could that be true, or is that...
Yeah, I did. I thought it would have been kind of hip for him to do something like that. And I played it for Streisand, too, because I did some record with her where I played piano on one of her albums. But she thought people would really believe it, that she meant it. And she's probably right. You know, she's almost too big. But it would have been kind of good for Sinatra to sing, you know, it's lonely at the top, you know, you know, it's one of those show business whines, you know, about, oh, it's, I know I've got $1 million and I'm famous and don't have to work very hard, but I'm still lonely, you know. I mean, who cares?
So did he ask you to write a song for him? Or did you just write it?
No, he was going to do Think It's Gonna Rain, and I got together with him and talked to him for a while, mostly about his plane, but he was going to do something of mine, and there was some talk about it. Yeah, but I did write that with him in mind, certainly.
Well, the arrangement that you gave when you sang it yourself is almost Kurt Weill-ish in a way.
Yeah.
What did you envisage for him when you were writing it for him?
That same sort of chart, you know. I mean, uh-huh. it would have been arranged the same way. The song's laid out like that. You know, with the saxes and some clarinets, you know, sort of... bit of a cheat, you know. That's the way I'd have done it with him. Maybe a little more lush.
So he was horrified by the song, huh?
No.
Oh, oh.
He wasn't at all. On that one, I wasn't exactly there when he reacted to it. It was Think It's Gonna Rain was interested him. He was gonna do that.
Well, let me just play a few seconds of this.
And okay.
This is Lonely at the Top, Randy Newman singing his own song from an album put out in around 1972. And this has a double irony when you were singing it, since you weren't even at the top.
Yeah, I'll say. And there were, I think it was on this live album I did, too, that there were about six people at the bitter end at a third show on Friday night.
Yeah. Okay, let's hear Randy Newman singing Lonely at the Top.
My pick of any girl, you'd think I'd be happy, but I'm not. Everybody knows my name, but it's just a crazy game. Oh, it's lonely at the top.
Randy Newman singing his own song. It's still a great song.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds good. I'd have done it a little more lush for him, about double the size band at least, and strings.
Right. Well, I want to hear some more stuff from your new record and talk with you some more. But first, we're going to take a short break. Randy Newman is my guest singer, songwriter, pianist, composer, arranger. He's got his first new album in 5 years, and it's called Land of Dreams. We'll hear more from it after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Randy Newman is my guest, and I want to play something from his new album, Land of Dreams. And I want to play the song I Want You to Hurt Like I Do.
Mm-hmm.
This is a terrific song. And, you know, we were talking before about autobiography, and this is a very dangerous song to record in a way, because everybody, mm-hmm. I'm sure, will think, what a malicious guy he is.
Yeah, you know, it is. I never think of that. I do write about absolutely anything for a song, because it's more important than... my life to me, but it's caused me some trouble. You know, People magazine gets interested and things like that. Awful things.
Well, let's hear this. This is I Want You to Hurt Like I Do, and we'll talk about it a little more after we hear it.
not all my children. And I ran out on my wife. Gonna run out on you too, baby. Everybody cried the night I left. Almost everybody did. My little boy just hung his head. I put my arm around his little shoulder.
You really seem to assume it's such a universal feeling of wanting someone to feel the same pain you do.
I don't know. I don't assume that. I hope it isn't so.
Probably
is. I think
is.
It might be. I think it might be. I mean, it's like close.
This is your first new album in about 5 years, and for, I think, about two of those years, you had Epstein-Barr syndrome.
Yeah, I did. I've talked about it ad nauseum, but I did. There was something the matter with me, I'll tell you that.
Well, this is this, I think, viral condition that causes chronic exhaustion, but it's not completely diagnosable, from what I understand. And I was wondering if that made it harder for you because you couldn't get this lab test that would tell you 100% for sure that you had something.
Well, they give you a lab test that tells you. It's the hardest thing for people that think they have it or have, as you see, you know, I'm uncertain myself. It may have been, I mean, I can't believe it was like in my head because I, you know, couldn't get up steps without getting tired, and now I can. The hardest thing about it is that you think you're nuts, you know, because there's doctors who believe it, there's doctors who don't believe in it. They'll say, it was a fashionable diagnosis. But there are people who've been devastated, you know, that they've attributed it to this, and they've had to give up their jobs, and they can't drive a car, and it was a hell of a thing, you know. It's like there was nothing to look forward to. It's similar to what depression is or you know, some stress-related thing, but whatever it was, it was hard getting around.
I would think that one of the really hard parts would be not being sure if it was a medical condition or an existential crisis.
It is, but then you get someone to tell you that, like me, I'm telling people now, you're not nuts, you're sick if it's this that you have, It absolutely was one of the hardest things about it. The hardest thing about it is that it's really debilitating. You know, it affects sleep. You know, I'm sure in 10 years they'll say that this thing didn't really exist and it was some kind of stress-related hysteria. But I believe it existed because it really was different. All of a sudden, things like exercise, which make you feel better usually, for sure, they're a guarantee of feeling better, make you feel worse. So something changed.
So you're all recovered now?
I'm essentially better from it. I would hate to admit that I'm... It was like getting a doctor's note to explain your life, you know? But I'm basically better, yeah.
Were you able to write at all during this period?
Yeah, I was. I just didn't think it was any good, necessarily. I mean, I wrote stuff, and I'd call a friend who knew me well, and I said, well, am I getting, like, much worse? Am I... getting decrepit, you know, and this stuff is like not as good as I used to do. He says, no, that's fine. What are you talking about? I said, well, usually a song would make me, I'd write a song and it'd make me happy for weeks. I mean, I would be invulnerable to anything. I mean, a car could run over my foot or anything could happen and it wouldn't bother me because that's what I'm supposed to do. That's how I feel good about myself. And nothing could bother me, absolutely nothing. But this thing was only lasting me, I'd write something that I'd like, and it would be 10 minutes, and I'd be all, like, tired out and think it was everything was terrible, and, oh, man, it was terrible. It was bad.
Do you feel guilty when you don't write, in addition to unfulfilled?
Eventually, yeah, I think I do, and eventually it gets too much, because I've had these, you know, ridiculous hiati, that are inexcusable, you know, even if you're sick or doing movies or going to lunch or something. But I do feel a little guilty about it, but my work habits are getting better.
One last thing. You know, there's always been this ethic in rock and roll that since everybody was so young when they started playing rock and roll and it was a youth music, the question was always, could rock and rollers grow up and still have a music to play? It seems to me that wouldn't have ever really been a problem for you in the sense that you weren't the kind of frenetic rock and roller on stage jumping around or bouncing on top of the piano. Do you know what I mean? You were always writing songs that even had a foot in Tin Pan Alley as well as rock and roll.
I thought about it, though. I mean, we all thought that it's just none of us are getting off the stage. This is like the first generation. You know, Bill Wyman of the Stones is like 50-something. Moody Blues are all 86, 87. you know, I'm up there. McCartney. We're not going away like we had thought. You know, I remember people saying, well, I'm not going to be doing this when I'm 30. Are you kidding? And everyone would laugh. Yeah, well, 30, yeah. And I'm not going to be doing this when I'm 40. I don't know what's going to happen. They're going to have to, like, start, you know, having mandatory retirements or something.
Did you have a fantasy of what you'd do if you, quote, grew up and outgrew music?
I guess I do movie music, though it's a brutal way to make a living, I'll tell you.
Do you like to perform?
Yes, sure do. I prefer it to write. I mean, writing's where I live, but performing is always, it's something that I know that I'm good at. I actually, one of the few areas of my life that I have genuine confidence about.
When you're writing and you say you hate to write, do you like to go someplace else to do it away from home?
Yeah, I have to, or I'll just lie down. I have to go to go to a job and do it every day.
Does it work?
Yes.
I mean, are you lucky enough so that the songs come to you when you're sitting there waiting for them to come?
Yeah. I've read things about when I was still reading them, about having writer's. I've never had writer's block. It's just hard getting started.
Uh-huh.
But once I go, there'll be some days where nothing happens, something always happens eventually. It's just hard waiting through the days when it doesn't sometimes.
Well, I want to thank you so very much for talking with us. I really enjoy the new record. Thank you for
with us. It's a pleasure being here.
Randy Newman has been my guest. His new album, Land of Dreams, is on Warner Brothers Records. And Randy Newman will also perform on Saturday Night Live this weekend. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.